Good morning. So last time we talked a bit about what stalling would look like for our control hazards. So control hazards were where we couldn't figure out what the program counter should be, namely in our processor, conditional jump and return. And one's generic solution for hazards is just to wait until we have the information we need. So in the case of these control hazards, to wait until we can figure out what the actual address of the next instruction to run is. We looked at that. And we said, well, for return, that's what we ended up doing. For conditional jump, that's not what we ended up doing. We did instead this idea of branch prediction, where we guessed where it would go. And for a conditional jump, this was actually fairly easy to make a guess. We just had two possibilities. If we choose one of them at random, we're going to be right probably about half the time. And we chose for our design just that we'd always guess it was taken, but we could have made some other strategy for guessing. Now, if we guess correctly, then, well, we've just saved some time where we would otherwise be stalling, and we don't have to do anything else. If we guess incorrectly, well, we have to undo the guess we made. And we had this trick that the way our conditional jump worked, it turned out that by the time we would have figured out that our guess was wrong, not much had actually happened. So we could undo the guess by just clearing out pipeline registers. We didn't need to make any other changes. And that's how we would do that. So we had talked a bunch about the logic for handling sort of these hazards with stalling, and in the case of our conditional jump, squashing, that is undoing those instructions. But we didn't really talk about how to implement them before, so we started talking about how we would implement them. And the big thing is we wanted to control what our pipeline registers did. And we learned that we could do this by sort of writing muxes by hand, but we had some built-in functionality. We had a write-disable signal on our pipeline register banks called stall, which would keep the old values because we'd not write new values. And we had a reset signal, which would restore to the default. And it turns out that pretty naturally our defaults are going to correspond to a not, because when we think of starting our processor up in the first cycle, we don't want the write back stage to write anything. We don't want the memory stage to be reading or writing memory. So our defaults are all going to correspond to a no op instruction pretty naturally. So resetting is going to make the values in the pipeline register be a not in the next cycle. And we can set these signals to make our pipeline registers do what we needed. The question is, like, how do we know when to do that? And a big thing we figured out is that, well, we can check the things in our pipeline registers and figure out what's going on. So for example, for return, if we wanted to figure out, am I waiting for a return to finish, I can check, is there a return in the execute stage by looking at the pipeline registers that feed the execute stage. And that's sort of the basic technique we'll have for being able to write this logic. Another thing you mentioned is that, well, the naming of these signals that our textbook authors chose maybe isn't the best for not being confusing. So we talked about stalling. And in stalling, we kept an instruction back. And you might say, okay, we need to keep an instruction back. We have these special control signals. So I'm just going to set the stall one, right? And that's not right. We need to set both a stall signal and a bubble signal. So if we think of our case where we have, say, M remove Q followed by an add, we have to do a stall because after the M remove Q's execute stage, the add doesn't have the result of that if we need to forward from the value from memory. And we're going to have to delay and do one cycle of stalling. And in that cycle of stalling, if we think of what's happening to our pipeline registers, we want the decode registers to stay the same. That's our stall signal. Great. We want the execute to memory registers to do the normal thing. Great. But we don't want the decode to execute registers to do the normal thing, because if they did that, we'd have two copies of the add instruction. We probably don't want to run them twice. We also want to stall it, because then we'd have two copies of the add remove queue instruction. So we want to set it to a bubble signal. And I think if I were writing our textbook, I'd probably name these like write, disable, and reset to avoid this type of confusion, but that's not what we have. Okay. Some questions about these things we covered last time? Okay, so we talked a bunch about doing the logic for pipeline register values. We're missing one thing, which is the program counter. So we mentioned that we were like changing when we run instructions to handle the program counter update, but we didn't sort of mention how we're gonna build our program counter. So I'm gonna show you the design our textbook chooses. So we have our PC here, and we have our normal case where we take our PC, also combined with sort of the I code, so to get its instruction length, and compute our next program. This is the most, you know, their HCL1 simple program counter is program counter of is set to the address of the next instruction, so program counter plus instruction length. We also have a case where we have an immediate value from an instruction. This is for call jump, and also our prediction for conditional jumps. And I have, like our textbook, relabeled our PC register to be our predicted PC because it turns out it's a prediction now. It's not necessarily the real instruction we're supposed to be executing. Then I have a case where I need to repeat the previous PC for stalls. So I have a third case here where I just feed back my previous PC in case of a stall, because if I'm not fetching, putting a new instruction in decode, I better not put a new instruction in fetch either, or else I'm gonna forget the instruction that's currently in fetch. Right, if I'm keeping an instruction in decode, and there's an instruction in fetch, well, that instruction in fetch dot's going on to decode, so if we want it to be somewhere, better stay in fetch. And this is a way we would do that. Now, here I've drawn this as part of the same mux that the other stuff is part of. We could try to take advantage of the built-in version of this with a stall signal, but I don't recommend doing that because of some things we'll do later, but it would work either way for what we had so far. So then we have to deal with mispredictions. So if we have a misprediction, I'm gonna need to correct that misprediction. And what our textbook authors have chosen to do in their design is that this is our predicted PC and we fix up the prediction afterwards just before we fetch in the case where we detect a misprediction. So this would be in our memory stage of our jump, and we have just figured out in the previous cycle what the actual target of the jump is, and we want to have that override what we normally do. And our textbook authors would do this just before we fetch that actual place the jump is supposed to go, rather than figuring out in the cycle before. So they'll actually make the correction earlier. We'll figure this out in the cycle before in the jumps execute stage. We'll actually apply that correction just before we fetch the instruction. And something that I've done here is that you notice that my stalling case, I'm using this corrected value because if it turns out that we fix up a jump and then we need to stall, we want to still go where the jump was supposed to go. We don't want to go where we were predicting to go. So that's why my sort of stall value comes from this corrected version of the PC, not our prediction, which might have been wrong. And then we have a third possibility of we have a return address we've been waiting for from return. We're gonna also get that at the same time. So we're gonna have some bogus value in our program counter while we're waiting for the return. Then we're going to replace that with a value from the write-back stage of return. Why the write-back stage? Because in the previous cycle it was in the memory stage, and now we're grabbing the value while it's in the write-back stage of where the return actually goes. So if we think of where these values come from, so our immediate value for our predictions and our unconditional jumps and calls, that's coming from our instruction memory, so that's in the fetch stage. We're computing it for the next cycle. For these things that are fixing up the current fetch stage, we're gonna get the corrected PC for jumps from the pipeline registers between execute and memory. since it's going to be while the jump's in its beginning its memory stage, we're going to steal a value from its pipeline registers and use it in our fetch stage in the cases where we need to correct an old misprediction. And similarly for return, we're going to get a value from the memory to write back register, so a value that was computed in the memory stage in the previous cycle, we're going to grab from the pipeline registers and use to replace the PC we have, which doesn't reflect the return yet. Okay, some questions about this design for our PC update. So this is how a textbook build things, and so this is what I'm presenting and what sort of our assignment will present as the first option. Another way we could have built it, which maybe would have been simpler, is we could have done all this logic before the PC register, in which case we'd get our corrected address would come from not the memory and write-back stages, but from the executing memory stages, because we'd be doing it just in the cycle before we fetch the right thing, rather in the cycle while we're going to fetch, in which we're going to fetch the corrected thing, in which we're going to use the result of the return or the real result of the jump. But our textbook author sort of arranges this logic, so part of it's at the beginning of fetch and part of it's in the previous cycle. So, no questions? I was expecting more questions. Okay. So, we have our program counter update. So, after we've done all our work about doing forwarding prediction, we need to stall when we have our memory output needing to fetch. So, this is return followed by anything. So, this is something we don't solve. It turns out that real processors do actually do branch prediction for this. We don't, because mainly, like, how would we guess where the return address goes to? Real processors do that by remembering recent places where calls happened. But we're not going to implement that extra logic, but it is something that real processors do because, well, it saves 3 cycles of stalling every time you do it. In a real processor with a longer pipeline, maybe more than 3 cycles. And also when the memory output's needed an execute, we don't have a great solution for that. So this means that every time we have an error move queue or a pop queue, these are the 2 instructions that read a value from memory into a register, followed by a use of that register that was just read, we have a cycle of stalling we can't really avoid. And so we end up, with, you take a processor, which is pretty good. We pick 1 instruction every cycle, except for that stalling from memory to execute dependencies, which our textbook calls a load use hazard, and 3 cycles of stalling for returns, and that 2-cycle penalty, so it's not stalling because we're doing stuff, but 2 cycles where we're using instructions that won't do anything for conditional jump. That's 2 cycles where we're running instructions that we're going to get rid of later on because we were wrong about our prediction. Okay, so have our nice fancy processor. We're going to talk about some things that our processor doesn't implement, and this is kind of a preview of things we'll talk about for a lot of the rest of the semester. So one thing that we kind of have glossed over is our memory. So we've said we have an instruction memory and a data memory. They each take 1 cycle. And if you remember to the beginning of the semester, I told you that this was false, that our memory is really slow, it takes a while to communicate with. So how does memories actually work? So our next big topic is going to be on caches, which is how these memories actually work. And caches allow for fast access, but to a small number of things. So for that small number of things, we're actually going to have something like that 1-cycle performance. Maybe not actually 1 cycle, but very close. And typically in practice, we'll get that like over 90% of the time. But sometimes it's going to take many cycles. So this means that, you know, our processor is going to have sort of this very variable performance, it sounds like. We're going to talk, you know, where sometimes it's nice and efficient, and sometimes we have to do lots of waiting. So we're going to talk about some ways in which we might, some sort of high-level ways that processors mitigate this that we'll go into more detail later in the semester. But we're also going to talk about, like, how do we make it so that this first case is usually what happens, not the second case. So there's sort of two big extensions to pipelining that modern laptop, desktop, mobile phone processors tend to do, which are, I'll call, multiple issue and out of order. So these are things that are going to be done in addition to pipelining. So multiple issue means starting more than one instruction per cycle. So we can have set up our processor so we can run multiple instructions at the same time. We can fetch multiple instructions, we can decode multiple instructions, which means our register file now has to have twice the number of inputs. And we can execute multiple instructions, so we better have more ALUs. Maybe we can do memory stage, so we can set that up. And this is something that real processors have some version of this. There's lots of variations. And the advantage is, of course, that when it works, we can run twice as many instructions in the same amount of time. The disadvantage is, well, that's not always going to be possible. Here, it happens that the instructions I have for these first two are independent of each other. So I can run them at the same time and there's no problem. But if, like, they both used, if the second one used R9, well, we can't actually run it at the same time as the first one because it needs to get the results. Another thing is that if we think of the forwarding, we've just made the forwarding, we've doubled the number of forwarding cases, more than doubled actually, we've like quadrupled the number of forwarding cases we have to deal with. So we've made all the hazard handling a lot more complex. And also we have similar things for, you know, low to use hazards, anything all more complex. Another thing we can do that's maybe more directly useful for our example of multi-cycle memories is that rather than stalling, we can have our processor try to run instructions that don't depend on what we're stalling. So for example, in this case, I have this MR move queue followed by a subtract that uses it. And this takes a while, apparently. And what would be nice to do instead is run these later instructions that don't depend on R8 or R9. And real processors actually do this. They have a way where they can run instructions out of order while they're waiting for older instructions to finish, which are slow, usually because of like a slow access to memory. Now, there's a lot of extra logic on this, so the hazard handling is obviously a lot more complicated. We need to, for example, while we're waiting to run this subtract into R9, we need to make sure we don't run any instructions that need R9 until the value's ready. We need to do a lot of extra bookkeeping for that. And we need to still provide the illusion that the instructions run in order. We'll talk later in the semester sort of at a high level how that works. We're not going to try to implement it. It's pretty complicated to actually implement. We'll give sort of a high level overview of an implementation design for this. But this is something that real processors do. It's obviously a lot of extra work in addition to pipelining to make it happen. But it's really beneficial, especially when you have cases where our caches don't actually take one cycle all the time. So we talked, so I mentioned just briefly our overview of a bunch of tricks. We're going to go in more later for getting better, you know, more performance in addition to pipelining using similar techniques that like run more instructions at a time, run instructions more cycles, handle hazards by not just stalling, but by doing some other work. Now, even when you do all of this, we still run into cases where hazard handling is, you know, means that our pipeline doesn't actually run at the maximum number of instructions per cycle it could. And when that happens, the length of our pipeline starts really matter. So remember when we started talking about pipeline, I talked about throughput versus latency. And we kind of glossed over latency since then, right? We just didn't, like, latency didn't really matter, right? Only throughput. But a case where latency kind of does matter is that when we have to have cases where we have hazards, well, we're going to be waiting for something to go through enough pipeline stages, and the number of pipeline stages is going to increase if our pipeline is longer, right? We need to wait for the value to be computed. We care how long it takes to compute the value, not what our cycle time is. But we're thinking about, like, how long do I need to wait when I'm stalled? So this is a case where that latency catches up to us when we have hazard time. And therefore, we tend to have larger penalties if we have a longer pipeline. And this is something you can get into trouble with. And sort of an interesting historical example was Intel's Pentium 4 project. So in the early 2000s, late 90s, people marketing processors really, really liked advertising high clock rates. They wanted to have the highest clock rate of anyone, because that's what consumers had the impression was determined processor performance. And so Intel and the Pentium 4 said, we're going to have a really high clock rate. And to do that, of course, we're going to have a really long pipeline. And they had this processor design, which had 2 to 3 times as many pipeline stages as other processors on the market. And the intention was that it would have a much, much higher clock rate than other processors on the market. They didn't quite achieve that in their first version. They only managed to get the clock rate like 50% higher, which was not what they were designing for. And this meant that those sort of hazard handling penalties, those delays, even though sort of the optimal performance of the processor, like if we imagine like the optimal case of like running, in this case it's multiple issues, so starting like 2 instructions every cycle would have been a lot faster. In practice, it didn't achieve it. And a contemporary review said, for today's buyer, the Pentium 4 simply doesn't make sense. It's slower than the competition in just about every area. So that's what people reviewing processors said about this. Because even though sort of the optimal performance was faster for typical programs, you had lots of hazards that weren't handled well, and it didn't work out very well with the initial releases where they didn't get the clock speed quite as high as they wanted to. And I would say that, you know, since the early 2000s, we had a change in processor marketing where we no longer like advertise that the best processors are the ones that run at like 3.5 gigahertz. That was the attitude back then, which like led to this sort of type of failure. So questions on our sort of pipelining extensions. Okay, so let's talk a bit about caches. It'll be our main topic for the next few days. So we have this model that we take 1 cycle per access. We know that can't actually happen. And our solution, why that's going to happen, is that we're going to keep parts of the memory in fast storage we call caches. This fast copy can be accessed quickly, and our hope is we almost always use the copy. So to illustrate sort of what caches look like kind of in practice, I have this microscope photo of a 2004 CPU. Why 2004? Because it's a single core CPU, so I don't have to worry to talk about multiple cores, and because people have figured out roughly where most of the components are, which might be harder to do with a more modern CPU. So where I've highlighted in red, that's apparently where the registers files for this processor are. So there's a integer register file and a floating point register file. And they don't physically actually take up that much of the processor space. They happen to be located next to the ALUs for integer operations and the ALUs for floating point operations. We also have an level 1, L1, data cache and instruction cache. So here's our level one data cache, level one instruction cache. So these are what we would have in our processor design as the instruction memory and the data memory. And you can see they're substantially bigger than our register files, and they have some amount of storage. And rather than talking to memory directly, these level one caches talk to a bigger cache, which is this level two cache, which, yes, takes up much more than half the processor. And that is very typical, that caches will be most of the space on the processor. So this instruction cache and data cache talk to this level two cache here. That's most of the space on the processor devoted to that. Considerably more space than is devoted to registers. Considerably more space than is devoted to actual ALUs, even for floating point. It's devoted to caches. And also considerably more space than is devoted to decoding x86 instructions, which is actually fairly complicated because the x86 encoding is way harder than binary 6. So that's L1 cache. And on a more modern processor, like a typical multi-core, we also often have an L3 cache in addition. And these form kind of a hierarchy. So our registers are our smallest storage, our L1 cache is the next biggest. And so this sort of pyramid represents, like, we have bigger sizes as we go down this hierarchy. We also have slower speeds. So accessing a register should typically takes one cycle. So that's going to be, if we have more than a gigahertz processor, well less than a nanosecond. We talked about accessing memory taking about a cycle. In practice, often the level one caches, which are the memories, take longer than that, take like 3 cycles. But you can start one access every cycle. So they're pipelined, so you can start an access every cycle, and it takes, and you'll get the result like 3 cycles later, often the sort of way they work. So the sort of typical time is 1 nanosecond. These are all approximate times because there's a bunch of variation, but I'm giving you sort of the right order of magnitude. But some processor could be much faster or much slower in the numbers we have for this. The L2 cache would typically be a bunch bigger. So our L1 caches are going to be like tens of kilobytes on a modern processor. Our L2 cache will be like hundreds of kilobytes, but will have typically take an access time of something like 5 nanoseconds. And if we have an L3 cache, that would typically on a modern processor be megabytes, but have an access time of something like 20 nanoseconds, and main memory would be order 100 nanoseconds. Access time. And these access times are latency, so they're not, throughput is a different story. Like the throughput does get lower as you go down, but not as severe. But these are latency times. So just how long it takes each access, the story of like how much can you access over a period of time is a little more complicated. We're mostly not gonna be concerned with it. Questions on sort of this hierarchy we have and the variation in performance. Okay, so we talked about having these level one caches, which are our memories. So what do they look like? And we've basically shown you the memory interface for our HCL assignments. We put in an address, we put in an input if we're writing, we have some signal that controls whether we're writing, we get a value out. We're gonna need at least one other thing to make these work as caches, which is that, well, sometimes the cache is not going to have a value right away, so there's going to be some signal it sends to the processor saying, hey, I have this value or I don't have this value. And if it doesn't have this value, we're going to have to do something to handle it, like stalling in probably our design, or in a more sophisticated design, maybe we'd find other instructions to run while we're waiting for it. And we're going to talk just in our processor to this data cache. So what happens if the data cache doesn't have the value? It's going to get it for us. So we're not going to actually talk to memory directly. In our processor design, we talk to the level one cache level one cache talks to level two and everything else. So we're just dealing with this first level of cache. That's all the processor deals with. The first level of cache for data and instructions. Those are responsible for actually communicating with the next levels of the memory. So the processor is going to like ask to read a bunch of values. So in this example, the processor asks to read address ABCD. In this case, the cache doesn't have that value, so it asks the main memory or the next level of cache for it. It gets it and it forwards it back to the CPU. And presumably when it gets it, it's also going to cache it for later, so it doesn't have to ask the memory again. And in this example, when the processor asks for address 1234, well, it seems like the cache had it stored already, so it didn't need to ask the memory for it, and we saved a lot of time. Because talking to the memory is going to be a lot slower. So questions about this sort of interface cache provides our processor? Okay, so we've talked about the interface, we've talked about sort of the raw performance at each level, and sort of our goals when we're designing our caches and all those levels we're going to put together is that we want to provide the performance of our L1 cache for really small and therefore really fast. And this means that we want to have it most of the time we're accessing those fast storage. So yes, sometimes we're going to have to access slow storage, but we want that to be very rare. So if we have 100x difference in speed, we want like over 99% of the time we're doing the fast thing. So only 1% of the time are we spending 100 times longer. So that's, you know, not that much of an impact on our overall performance. So that's our hope, is that we have a really, really high rate of accessing values only in these fast caches. Even though, yes, that's not going to happen all the time, we want it to be really high, so our performance looks similar to that fast storage. So that's almost all the time what is happening. Only rarely do we go to the slower storage. But we also want to provide the capacity of the largest memory. We still want the program to be able to access gigabytes of data. And it seems like these goals are in conflict. Like, how can we access gigabytes of data when the only way we're getting the performance we want is if we're accessing these smaller, faster storages? Like, that seems like a contradiction. And indeed, it's not always possible. Like, there's programs where we can't provide this illusion. But for typical programs, the programs are written in a way, just naturally, where we have these, where we can provide these two properties at once. Could provide performance very similar, not the same, but very similar to our fast, small memory, and make it look to the program like they're dealing just normally with large amounts of data. And there's two assumptions about the program's behavior we're going to take advantage of. So one is something we'll call temporal locality. That when a program accesses a value, it's going to access that value again sometime soon. So if we see an access to a memory location, it's likely to be accessed again in the near future, meaning we should put it in our cache, and by doing so, we will have those future accesses use our fast storage and get our high performance. Another property is that if a value is accessed, nearby values, values with nearby addresses, will be accessed soon. So this means that if we see the program accessing a value, we should also bring in a bunch of values from around it in memory. And remember I told you that those numbers for the speed of accessing memory were latency, so bringing in a larger amount of data is not a big cost. You know, if we have to access memory anyways, it's going to still take about the same amount of time, not exactly the same amount of time, to get like 4 bytes from memory versus 100 bytes. So these are two assumptions we'll make about our programs that we're going to be mostly true. Yes, your question?
Yeah, so is writing, like, memory, is cache work for that?
The question is cache work for writing? Yes. We're going to talk about reading for the next little while, but we'll get into how caches work for writing, and they will help us with writing. But that is a bit more complicated, which is why it's not what we're going to talk about first. and therefore we will be concerned with writing for locality. So this idea of temporal locality, if it's accessed now, will be accessed again soon. And spatial locality, if it's accessed now, nearby things will be accessed soon. These are just natural properties of programs, that if you write a program, it has temporal and spatial locality with almost all the time, unless you're trying not to. There's nothing that guarantees all programs to be this way, but this just naturally happens. If we look at real programs, these properties hold true. And to show why that is, let's look at this example here. This is a function to compute the meaning of an array in C. And this has good temporal and spatial locality. So if we think about the code, the machine code in the loop here, that whatever those instructions are, those are fetched lots and lots of times. If we see them being fetched once, they're likely to be fetched again in the future. Not always, of course, but most of the time. So that has good temporal locality. That's something our cache can take advantage of by storing those instructions in the cache. So when they're fetched after the first iteration of the loop, they keep being accessed very quickly. We have good spatial locality for the machine code, that if we think of our machine code, most of the time, the instruction we run after the current one is next to it in memory, is the following address. So if our cache takes advantage of that by fetching a bunch of instructions at once, we're going to save a bunch of time. And I wasn't doing anything to try to have good locality with the code, but it just happens, just naturally, really hard to not have it happen. We also have good locality for our data. So our variables total, I, and length have great temporal locality. When we see them being accessed, they're likely to be accessed again soon. Now, probably this doesn't help our cache in this case because they're probably stored in registers, not memory. So we're getting the advantage of that by the compiler putting them in a register, but we have this property in these variables of temporal locality, and if they did end up being in memory, it would be something we'd want to cache. And we have good spatial locality. If we think of our array values, when we see one element of values being accessed, the next one's likely to be accessed soon, and our cache can take advantage of this by bringing in more than one element at a time. So questions about these examples of temporal and spatial locality? So you can see that we have these properties, and they really are natural properties of programs. They're things that just happen by accident in any program you write. And this is why caches can work, because we can indeed write a program which doesn't have these properties, which has very bad temporal locality, very bad spatial locality. It's just that these are not common programs that you run. Okay, so we know sort of what we want, so what we're taking advantage of a cache. Let's talk about building a very specific, simple cache design, which is going to be a direct map cache. So to start out, I'm going to say I want my cache to store, in this case, I have 8 bytes of data. And I'm going to divide those 8 bytes into 2-byte blocks. Why am I dividing them into 2-byte blocks? Well, I don't want to divide them into 1-byte blocks because I want to take advantage of spatial locality. I know that if I'm accessing 1 byte of memory, I'm likely to access the byte before or after more than anything else because of spatial locality. Like, not guaranteed to be true, but it's something I want to take advantage of. So I'm going to make sure I store more than 1 byte together. Now, here, I have only 8 bytes, so I'm storing 2-byte blocks, but in a more realistic cache, our blocks might be like 64 bytes, and our cache might be kilobytes, for example. But just because my whole cache is only 8 bytes, I'm not going to have a 64-byte block that wouldn't fit on this. So I have 2-byte blocks, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to divide up memory into blocks of the same size. So I've divided up my memory, rather than into bytes, into these 2-byte blocks. And my policy here is that when I store something in this cache, I'm going to take one of these blocks of memory, one of these 2-byte blocks of memory, and put them in one of those 4 spaces in the cache. So I'm always reading more than a byte for memory to take advantage of spatial locality. So I'm just divided, just arbitrarily decided I'm going to read 2 bytes at a time for memory. And I'm dividing that memory into these 2-byte size candidates for me to put in the cache. Okay. So let's say I have this cache, and the processor asked me to read this memory address, 01011. If we look at our memory here, 01011, that is this BB here. So that's what the processor is asking me to read. That value. But since I'm implementing cache, what I want to do is I want to figure out, is this BB anywhere in this cache? And well, I don't actually know that the value is BB. All I know is this memory address. But the problem is, with what I have so far, I can't figure out where it would be in the cache. I need some extra information. So one thing I need to know is, like, which of these blocks do I need to look at? And to start out, we're going to keep things simple by choosing a design where there's going to be only one block we're going to check. And the way we're going to do that is, since I've divided up memory into these fixed size blocks, I'm going to assign each of the rows of my cache to specific blocks of memory. So what I'm going to say, for example, is the first row of the cache, which I'll say is index 0, can either correspond to the first block of memory, or the fourth block of memory, sorry, or the fifth block of memory, because I can count, or the ninth block of memory, and so on. And I'm going to say the second block of the cache can correspond to the second block of memory, or the sixth block of memory, or the tenth block of memory, and so on. So I'm just taking the blocks of memory and sort of saying, assigning them consecutively to the rows of the cache, and when I go to the end, I wrap around. And the reason I'm doing it in this particular way, rather than, like, for example, you know, you might say, why do we want to do this, rather than just saying this first block goes to the first half of memory or some first quarter of memory. The reason I'm doing it like this is that if we think of, like, accessing an array, I want to be able to fit as much of the array as possible in the cache, so that's why I'm interleaving where they're assigned. So I have this assignment here that I've chosen just sort of statically. And because I've chosen to use powers of 2 here, one thing we can see is that, okay, because I've chosen to use powers of 2, first of all, you know, each block of memory has addresses that range from ending with a 0 to a 1. And that's because I chose a power of 2 size. I can just chop off the bits and get sort of an index of the block. So the first block, block 0, if we chop off the last bit, we have that this is block 0 at the beginning. Chop off the last bit, this is block 1. This is block 2. Just by chopping off the last bit, I get sort of the which row I'm in of memory. And I've also chosen a power of 2 number of rows in my cache. So to figure out whether a block of memory is assigned to the row 0 of the cache, index 0, I can look at the 2 bits in the middle. And this is just a consequence of me carefully choosing powers of 2 for all these values. We're going to always choose powers of 2, because it's going to be really convenient that I can figure out which row of the cache I go in by looking at 2 bits of the address. That's really fast and way better than if I had to, like, do division. That would be really annoying. And in this case, for example, we can see that index 01 is where this value we're looking for would end up, because we have those 2 bits in the address, and it works out that the value we're looking for has those 2 bits in it. But that's a consequence of how we assigned the blocks of the cache to blocks of memory, and using powers of 2 throughout, that we can use certain bits of the address to do it. This basically, in a way of thinking about how we figured out those bits, is we chopped off some bits that represent where on the block a value is. In this case, that was 1 bit, because we had 2 places to put a value in the block. And then we had a block number, and then you just wanted to see what the block number was mod 4. And mod 4 ended up looking at the bottom 2 bits. So this sort of cache design is called direct map because of this mapping here, that each block of memory is assigned to a specific place in the cache. And means there's exactly one place to look for each address or block. So I know that if I'm reading this byte of memory, that it must be either here or I have to go to memory. So that's my only place I need to look in the cache. Now, I still have a problem because, well, you know, if I assume it's in the cache, I'm going to say it's 0, but that's not the real value here. So we need some way of knowing that this cache hasn't been filled up yet. So we're going to add some extra data to the cache to say, well, we haven't put anything in this block yet. We're going to call this a valid bit. So it's initially 0, saying we haven't put anything there. And that's how I know that this is 0, is because I haven't filled it, not because I'm caching, not because it's a cache value I want to read. That it just happens to be 0, because we could store 0 in memory. Okay, so in this case, we're going to look at this valid bit being 0 and say, well, it's not cached, so we're going to go to memory. But remember, we're going to assume temporal and spatial locality. So we're going to bring in the whole block, because it's spatial locality, and we're going to store it, you know, everything, also because of temporal locality. So if you access any other part of the block soon, it should be a cache hit. You don't have to go to memory again. So we're going to fetch it, put it in the cache. We're going to mark it as valid because now it's filled in. But we still have a problem. And the problem is that this block here, this AABB, it could have come from this 2233. It could have come from this AABB here, memory. It could have come from there. And we don't want to look at the memory to check. We need to know when we look at the cache without checking the memory, where it came from. So we need to store where it came from. And one option would be, we could just store, you know, in here, that it came from, we could store, you know, the range of addresses it came from. But that's more information than we need to store. And there's two, and we're going to save some space on that. So one thing we can say is I don't need to store the range because I know the range always starts, you know, I can just store the start of the range. I also don't need to store the range always goes from 0 to 1, so I don't need to store that last bit. And I know if we're in the second row here that the next two bits are always 0, 1, because that's how we determine that determines what row it is. So I don't need to store those bits, so I only need to store 0, 1. And we'll call that our tag. So the tag is everything we didn't. So tag, we remove the last bits that indicate where in the block it is, because I only need to store which block it is, not the location within a block. And I remove the bits from the index because I know what this index is from what row I'm in, and I know that's the next bits of the address. Those are parts of the bits of the address. I don't need to store them. I just know, based on what row I'm in, what those are. We just store what's left over, and we call that the tag. Okay, so questions about what we overall are storing in this direct map cache. So what we'll end up with, sort of as a more general case, is we'll have our direct map cache, we'll have a bunch of rows, and we're going to divide up our address into three parts. So this middle part here is going to be what we'll call the index, and that's going to tell us which row to go to. So in this case, the index is 4, so we're going to row 4. And to make this work, we always have to have a power of 2 number of rows, or else we can't just use the middle bits, we have to do some division or something. So we're going to avoid that by having always a power of 2 number of rows. And once we extract the row, we're going to take this value out, and we're going to compare the tag, which is this top part of the address, to see if we have the right values in this data, we're also going to check the validate. And if the tag matches and the validate is true, we have a cache hit, meaning that it was found in our cache. We don't have to go to the next level. Now, of course, this address is asking for a particular byte. So in this case, our block starts at B4, and this is actually B6 that we're looking for. How do I know the block starts at B4? Because the blocks always start at all zeros in those last bits. So we're going to use our last 2 bits to figure out which part of the block it is. And why is it 2 bits? Well, I chose a power of 2 size for our block, in this case 4 bytes. So I need 2 bits to figure out which of those 4 bytes we're referring to. So we're going to use 2 bits to refer to which of those 4 bytes. And that's, we're going to call those 2 bits the offset. So we're going to divide up the address to this offset we use once we get the block from the cache to determine what the byte that the program is looking for. Or if we're thinking of like accessing 8 bytes, we'll, you know, the starting byte, and we'll get the rest of the bytes somehow. We're going to have the index determine which row of the cache this block value from memory could have been stored in, because we only have one place each value from memory can go. And we'll use the tag to figure out, did it come from that part of memory or some other part of memory which has some bits in common? Some questions? Operation for our direct mount cache here. Yes? What is the offset? The offset tells us where in the block we go. So this block here, this came from, this is from memory at 11100 through 111001. Right, it's a whole range of memory addresses that make up that block. It tells us which of those we're referring to. Does that answer your question? Yes.
So does this only access 1 byte at a time?
Question, does this only access 1 byte at a time? Yes, but we could easily change that. So we can change that by supplying more than 1 byte as sort of the inputs here, like providing, like we want 2 bytes. Right, we can supply B4 and B5 as the first input to this box, B5 and B6, and so on. We have a problem with the last byte, which we'd have to deal with specially, but that's not so much of a problem if like we have 64 byte cache blocks, for example. In real processors, what typically happens if you're accessing a value which goes across 2 cache blocks, the cache has to turn that into 2 cache accesses and then combine at the end. But for something within one, they'll modify this process here to extract multiple bytes at a time. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. Question, what happens if the tag is not exactly the same? So if the tag's not exactly the same, these values here are not the ones we care about. So if we go back to our example here, if I tried to read this cache at address 00011, the value I want to read is 33. And I should detect using the tag that even though 2233 would go here, that value is not what's being stored, and I know because of the tag. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so the tag is always the one that's checking that you're the right block.
Question, the tag's always checking that we have the right block here. Yes. Even checking the right block of the ones that can go in that row. Other questions? Okay. So one piece of terminology. So the term, I've been calling these rows of the cache. The sort of term we're going to see for that is a set. And a preview is that we're going to change how much is in a row later on. We're not going to do that for now. We're going to keep things simple. And sort of I showed you, we have our address split up into a tag, index, and offset. So we can figure out how big those are based on what our cache looks like. So for example, if we have 2 bytes in a block, like here and here, we're going to have 1 offset bit. And so that offset bit is always going to be at the end of our address, because the blocks always come from addresses that are next to each other. And if we have 4-byte blocks, well, that's 2 bits to determine which of the 4 bytes. And our block size is always going to be a power of 2, so we never have to worry about like 2.5 bits. No, that's not going to happen. It's always going to be a power of 2, so we're also having an integer number of bits. And in this case, we have 2 bits that are, again, come from the end of our address. For indexes, we're going to look at how many rows there are. So in this example here, we have 2 rows, so we have 1 index bit. And that index bit, that's going to come from what part of the address from before the offset. So in this case, the index, this 1 here, is the 1 from before the first 2 ones, because we already counted for those first 2 ones, those least significant 2 ones, I should say, in the offset. In the case of our 2-byte blocks, these 2 index bits here come from those 2 ones before the 1 offset bit we've already accounted for that cache. And for our final cache, we have 3 index bits because we have 8 rows, 2 to the 3 is 8. And these index bits all come from before the offset bit, the single offset bit. So questions, how I figured out how many index and offset bits here? And then everything left over is going to be the tag. So that's what we need to figure out, you know, of the multiple things which could have ended up in this part of the cache, which one do we have? Because we have a bunch spread apart in memory that could have ended up here. And I want to know, when I'm like looking at it, when I extract this FF, I want to check, did it really come from the address I'm looking for, or some other address which shares a bunch of bits in common? And the tag is going to let me do that, and the tag is just everything left over in the address. So we can see when we combine the tag, index, and offset, when we concatenate them together, we get back the original address in each case. That's sort of always how it works. Some questions? Lining up our addresses. Okay, so our textbook likes talking about how to compute the number of tag, index, and offset bits using formulas, which is fine. I prefer working from these diagrams, and you can see that these are equivalent. So for example, they say that if we know the number of sets is capital S, the number of set index bits is lowercase s, that's related by capital S equals 2 to the s, and we can see that in our example. Like we said, we had 8 sets. I need to solve for how many index bits. So 8 equals 2 to the what? 3, and 3 is the number of set index bits. And similarly, if we know our blocks are, you know, 4 bytes, then to know how many offset bits we are, that's 2 to the b. So 4 bytes, we need 2 bits to figure out which of those 4. This is just encoding that as a 4. So these formulas are just representing the sort of logic I was doing here, but you know, that's another way of approaching it. I prefer to present like the sort of visual, like how many bits do we need to determine which row we're in, that sort of thing, because I think it works better for understanding what's going on. And so we have figuring out the number of sets and the block size from the index bits and the offset bits. We also are figuring out the tag bits are, you know, if we take the total size of the address minus the number of index and offset bits together, everything left over, that's our tag. There's one term here I want to point out that's going to come up in other scenarios. So we talk about the cache size. And whenever we're talking about a cache size, the size we mean is the size of the data. So if you look at our caches here, we're actually storing a bunch of other information that is not the data. We'll call this metadata, so these valid and tag bits, and we're going to have some other things we need to store too later on. We do have to store those, but when someone talks about a cache being like an 8 kilobyte cache, the size they're referring to is the size of the data. They aren't referring to the size of that extra information, even though, yes, there is some, maybe a substantial amount. So questions on these formulas, where they come from? Okay, so let's do a little exercise here. So we've dealt with kind of cache sizes I can draw on slides. Let's do talk about a more realistic size. This would be actually a bit smaller than a typical L1 for like a laptop or desktop processor today. But let's say we have 64-byte blocks, 128 set cache. So it's going to be direct map, so it stores 64 times 128 bytes of data, which is 8 kilobytes. My first question, if addresses are 32 bits, then how many tag, index, and offset bits do we have? And then we have a second question for after that. So remember, we're splitting up our address into a tag, index, and offset. who needs more time for the first question? Okay, so let's start with offset bits. Who thinks we have 3 or less offset bits? 4 offset bits? 5 offset bits? 6 offset bits? 7 offset bits? 8 offset bits? 9 or more offset bits? No clue? Okay, so most people said 6, which is what I get. So we're thinking of offset bits. If we're thinking of our diagram here, offset bits are going to be how we're going to decide which of the different bytes we're choosing. And we have 64 byte blocks, so we have 64 bytes to choose from. And 64 is equal to 2 to the 6. So we need 6, exactly 6 bits is the information we need to figure out which of the 64 bytes we want to select. So I got 6 offset bits. So questions on how I figured that out? Okay. Let's do index bits last. Next. Who thinks we have 4 or less index bits? 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 or more. Okay, so we have a consensus on 7. So index bits are about determining which row we go in. So in this example here, our index is 4, and that says we go to row 4. So you want as many bits to count for all the possible rows we could go to. So if we're numbering the rows, you know, they're going to be numbered from 0 through 127, because we have row is set. So we have, because we have 128, we're going to need 2 to the 7, which is equal to 128, you know, rows. So we have 7 bits to determine which row we are in. Or another way you could think about it is the maximum index here, 127, if you write that in binary, that is going to be 7 ones. And the minimum is all zeros. Okay, so questions about how I figured that out? Okay, so then we have tag bits. So to figure out the tag bits, this is going to be 32 minus 7 plus 6, which, assuming I can do math, is 19. And that's 32 bits in total, and we've already accounted for the index and offset bits, so we need the remaining bits of our address. Those are going to be our tag. So questions? Okay. So who would like more time for the second part? Okay, so let's talk about our second part here. So this is saying we have bytes stored in the same block as 1037, and I would find it helpful for solving this problem to write this address, at least part of this address, in binary. Now we're at the whole thing in binary, just there's probably a bunch of answers. Okay, and this is a select multiple question. Multiple answers should be applicable. Okay, so who thinks it's stored in the same block as for A? Same block, or who would like more time? Okay, a bunch of people would like more time. I thought I asked that earlier, but that's not. So we'll give more time. So with the hint that I like writing out the address here, I think that's very helpful for solving this problem. And the way I wrote out this address is I just said each hexadecimal digit converts into 4 bits, because how hexadecimal works. So in the interest of having enough time to explain things, let's start. So who thinks A? Who thinks B? Thinks C? Thinks D? No clue? Okay, so I think our plurality is no clue. Our second is probably A through C, which is, so A through C are the answers I think is correct. So let's talk about how I do this. So I have my address in binary, and if I think about this address, I know these bottom six bits, this is the offset. And then we have our index plus tag. And we're asking what's in the same block. And if we go back to our diagram of blocks, we're asking basically, if I'm dividing up memory for this cache, is it in one of these blocks together? So what I'm concerned about is what's the range of addresses that we're gonna have here? And it's not gonna be 0 to 1, because we have 64 bytes in each block in this cache. So it's gonna be a bunch of zeros to a bunch of ones. And in particular, we're gonna have, you know, the block is gonna start at, you know, this address with an offset replaced with all zeros. That's gonna be the beginning of it. And it's gonna end at the same address with the offset replaced with all ones. Because that's gonna be the range of stuff we're gonna get pulled from memory. That's gonna be that row of memory when I listed out memory that we're gonna get. And if we convert this back to hexadecimal, this is address hex 1000 through hex 103F. So everything in that range, that's gonna be pulled into the cache at the same time. And everything out of it is going to be elsewhere. In particular, D0x41041, if we look at that address, it has a different index, so it's going to be in a different row of the cache. So it can't be stored together. So questions on how I figured that out? No, I'm out of time otherwise. Okay. So we'll talk more about how direct map caches work next time and present sort of an extension to solve one of the problems of direct map caches.